Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and feature reports is designed for people learning English. So, we speak slower than normal, using simple sentences and a limited vocabulary. Can you name 5 female rappers? Maybe 1 or 2 names immediately come to mind. But 5? You might have trouble because female artists are severely underrepresented in the hip-hop music industry. Later today, we explore that issue in the first part of our 3-part series, The Women of Rap. Also later, Mario Ritter reports some new details connected to a sunken treasure ship found in 2015. The ship was carrying gold, silver, and other valuables that could be worth many billions of dollars. And as always, we will close the show with an American story. Today, we listen to The Return of a Private by Hamlin Garland. But first,
I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet.
When musician and producer Sylvia Robinson first met young artists Big Bank Hank, Wonder Mike, and Master G, she gave them a name, the Sugar Hill Gang.
Well, so far you've heard my voice, but I brought 2 friends along. And next on the mic is my man Hank. Come on, Hank, sing that song.
Check it out, I'm the CAS.
And in 1979, she produced their first single, Rapper's Delight.
You see, I'm 6'1" and I'm tons of fun, and I guess to a D. You see, I got more clothes than Muhammad Ali, and I dress so viciously.
The song was a quick hit in the United States. It is widely considered to be the song that introduced the rap sound to the corporate world. In the 40 years since, hip-hop has become a multi-billion dollar industry. According to a recent report by the Nielsen Broadcast Rating Company, hip-hop is more popular than rock and pop for the first time in history. The report was released at the end of last year. It found that out of the top 10 most consumed music albums, 7 of them came from hip-hop. Sylvia Robinson, who died in 2011, was known as the mother of hip-hop. But in general, women within the genre are not as recognized as men. Hip-hop unquestionably remains a male-dominated industry.
Charis E. Kubrin is a professor of criminology, law, and society at the University of California, Irvine. In 2009, she released a joint study with Ronald Weitzer. Their research examined misogynistic themes in rap songs. The study looked at over 400 rap songs from the 1990s. Out of all of the songs they examined for the study, Kubrin noted that only 13 of them were by female rappers.
That doesn't mean female rappers didn't exist. Recall that these are commercially successful platinum albums. And so, you know, of course the question becomes, What happens that female rappers are not making it to these highest levels?
The University of Southern California Annenberg Inclusion Initiative is a research and advocacy group. In January, it released the results of a 6-year study on inclusion within the recording studio. The study found that from 2012 to 2017, women represented less than 23% of artists whose songs made Billboard's Hot 100 list. The study also showed that more than 90% of Grammy Award nominees between 2013 and 2018 were male. And it found that out of 651 music producers, only 2% were women. This lack of female artists shows how difficult it has been and continues to be for female rappers to break through, Kubrin says.
I keep waiting for this golden year, this golden time period to happen for female MCs. And I feel like the structural forces of the industry, right, all of these things are so strong that I'm not quite as optimistic as I used to be.
Last October, Cardi B became the first female rapper since Lauryn Hill in 1998 to have a song top the Billboard Hot 100 chart with no other credited artist.
Cardi B, you know where I'm at, you know where I be. You run the club, just to party, I'm there, I get paid a fee. I be in and out them banks so much, I know they tired of me.
For fans of female rappers, this marked a moment of hope. And yet, in some ways, Kubrin feels that things have moved backwards. There have been some female artists that have broken through, like Nicki Minaj. However, they remain the exceptions. Kubrin says that many of the difficulties female artists faced in the 1990s are still present today. She said, the gatekeepers in this industry are mostly men, and there's challenges that occurred back in the 90s that we're still seeing today. Female artists add much-needed diversity to the sounds of the hip-hop industry, Kubrin says.
You can look today and find lots of female rappers. Perhaps they're not making it in the mainstream, right? They're not having those platinum albums. But boy, are they bringing a diversity of perspectives.
Efforts like Where My Girls are providing more chances for female involvement within the music industry. New York-based rapper Day Burger launched Where My Girls in October. She named the initiative after her 2017 song. She hopes Where My Girls will empower young girls and help them find their music interests.
Just thinking with the idea of Where My Girls, it prompted us to, you know, maybe start an initiative where we can bring the younger girls in and, you know, maybe find their musical voice or production voice or, you know, just something I never had when I was a kid. So if you could find out young, it's gonna be great, you know?
I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
Ladies, we're my girls with the blonde hair. We're my girls with the jet black. We're my girls with the purple hair. Whip it everywhere. Whip it everywhere.
New details about a 300-year-old sunken treasure ship were released this week, with permission from groups involved in the search effort, including Colombia's government. The wreck of the Spanish ship San Jose was discovered in November 2015 with the help of a robotic device, an autonomous underwater vehicle. It is based at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in the United States. The institution reported details of the discovery on Monday. Rob Munier works for WHOI, which is a private, not-for-profit group. He said, "We've been holding this under wraps out of respect for the Colombian government." The exact place where the San Jose went down was a mystery for more than three centuries. It is sometimes called the Holy Grail of shipwrecks. By any measure, the sailing ship was very large in size and the treasure it held. The three-masted ship was carrying gold, silver, and jewels when it sank. The San Jose had 62 large guns, but it was sunk on June 8, 1708, with 600 people in a battle with British ships in the War of Spanish Succession. The San Jose may be the largest treasure ship ever found. Some suggest all the valuables could be worth as much as $17 billion. The WHOI was invited to join the search because of its expertise in deep sea exploration. Crews used an autonomous underwater vehicle called the Remus 6000. It helped find the wreckage of an Air France passenger airplane in 2009. The plane crashed in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, hundreds of kilometers off the coast of Brazil. The Remus 6000 discovered the wreck of the San Jose in more than 600 meters of water in November 2015. It took sonar images of the ship. The vehicle then got within 9 meters of the wreck to take pictures. Some of these include dolphin engravings on the San Jose's cannons. Mike Purcell is an engineer for the Woods Hole Institution and was a leader in the search effort. He said the wreck is partly covered with sediment. But he said the images were good enough to show identifying markings. Rob Munier received a telephone call from Purcell, but was far from the shipwreck. "It was a pretty strong feeling of gratification to finally find it," Munier said. "It was a great moment." However, ownership of the treasure is the subject of legal battles. The Associated Press reports that there are legal cases involving nations and private companies over claims to the shipwreck. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization has called on Colombia not to exploit the historic shipwreck for financial gain. Colombia has not signed the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. The treaty requires countries to follow international rules and to inform UNESCO of what will be done with shipwrecks. For now, the San Jose remains at the sea bottom. Where it rests is a state secret for Colombia. I'm Mario Ritter.
I started reading when I was a little over three. My father felt that it was best if we did our own reading. He said he had too many things he wanted to read himself to waste his time reading to us. He said, "If you want to read, learn to read." He said, "Hell, you learn to walk in 2 years, you can certainly learn to read in three." And so we all did. We all learned to read very early. And he helped us by saying to it that we had plenty of things to read. Reading was what you did. That's how you found out things. Even radio had not, in 1918 and 1919, when I was 6 or 7 years old, radio was just in coming into use in the Great War. And nobody had a radio. And it wasn't in the 1920s when people began to have that. And in those days, people moved a lot, and very often people left their whole libraries. We were hardly living in, you know, in abject poverty at any time. But we were able to move to houses where they were loaded with books. And so there were 4 children and 2 adults, and we'd move into that house like a pack of locusts and go through all the books there. And then my father would go out and rent another, what he called a furnished house, which meant it didn't matter whether there was any furniture in it, but it did matter if there were books in it.
That is the voice of the late, great cartoonist, animator, writer, filmmaker, and all-around artist, Chuck Jones. He is the subject this week on What It Takes from the American Academy of Achievement. To listen to the whole podcast, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com, for the audio file and transcript. Now it's time for An American Story, The Return of a Private, by Hamlin Garland.
The soldiers cheered as the train crossed the border into the state of Wisconsin. It had been a long trip from the south back to their homes in the north. One of the men had a large red scar across his forehead. Another had an injured leg that made it painful for him to walk. The third had unnaturally large and bright eyes because he had been sick with malaria. The 3 soldiers spread their blankets on the train seats and tried to sleep. It was a cold evening, even though it was summertime. Private Smith, the soldier with the fever, shivered in the night air. His joy in coming home was mixed with fear and worry. He knew he was sick and weak. How could he take care of his family? Where would he find the strength to do the heavy work all farmers have to do? He had given 3 years of his life to his country, and now he had very little money and strength left for his family. Morning came slowly with a pale yellow light. The train was slowing down as it came into the town of La Crosse, where the 3 soldiers would get off the train. The station was empty because it was Sunday. "I'll get home in time for dinner," Smith thought. She usually has dinner about 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. And he smiled. Smith and the other 2 soldiers jumped off the train together. "Well, boys," Smith began, "here's where we say goodbye. We've marched together for many miles. Now I suppose we are done." The 3 men found it hard to look at each other. "We ought to go home with you," one of the soldiers said to Smith. "You'll never be able to walk all those miles with that heavy pack on your back." "Oh, I'm all right," Smith said, putting on his army cap. "Every step takes me closer to home." They all shook hands. "Goodbye," Good luck. Same to you. Goodbye. Smith turned and walked away quickly. After a few minutes, he turned again and waved his cap. His two friends did the same. Then they marched away with their long, steady soldier's step. Smith walked for a while, thinking of his friends. He remembered the many days they had been together during the war. He thought of his friend Billy Tripp, too. Poor Billy. A bullet came out of the sky one day and tore a great hole in Billy's chest. Smith knew he would have to tell the sad story to Billy's mother and young wife. But there was little to tell. The sound of a bullet cutting through the air, Billy crying out, then falling with his face in the dirt. The fighting he had done since then had not made him forget the horror of that moment when Billy died. Soon the fields and houses became familiar. Smith knew he was close to home. The sun was burning hot as he began climbing the last hill. Finally, he reached the top and looked down at his farm in the beautiful valley. He was almost home. Mrs. Smith was alone on the farm with her three children. Mary was 9 years old, Tommy was 6, and little Teddy had just turned 4. Mrs. Smith had been dreaming about her husband when the chickens awakened her that Sunday morning. She got out of bed, got dressed, and went out to feed the chickens. Then she saw the broken fence near the chicken house. She had tried to fix it again and again. Mrs. Smith sat down and cried. The farmer, who had promised to take care of the farm while her husband was away, had been lazy and dishonest. The first year, he shared the wheat with Mrs. Smith. But the next year he took almost all of it for himself. She had sent him away. Now the fields were full of wheat, but there was no man on the farm to cut it down and sell it. 6 weeks before, her husband told her in a letter that he would be coming home soon. Other soldiers were returning home, but her husband had not come. Every day she watched the road leading down the hill. This Sunday morning she could no longer stand being alone. She jumped up, ran into the house, and quickly dressed the children. She carefully locked the door and started walking down the road to the farmhouse of her neighbor, Mrs. Gray. Mary Gray was a widow with a large family of strong sons and pretty daughters. She was poor, but she never said no to a hungry person who came to her farm and asked for food. She worked hard, laughed often, and was always in a cheerful mood. When she saw Mrs. Smith and the children coming down the road, Mrs. Gray went out to meet them. "Please come right in, Mrs. Smith. We were just getting ready to have dinner." Mrs. Smith went into the noisy house. Mrs. Gray's children were laughing and talking all at the same time. Soon she was laughing and singing with the rest of them. The long table in the kitchen was piled with food. There were potatoes, fresh corn, apple pies, hot bread, sweet pickles, bread and butter, and honey. They all ate until they could eat no more. Then the men and children left the table. The women stayed to drink their tea. "Mama," said one of Mrs. Gray's daughters, "please read our fortunes in the tea leaves. Tell us about our futures." Mrs. Gray picked up her daughter's cup and stirred it first to the left, then to the right. Then she looked into it with a serious expression. "I see a handsome man with a red beard in your future," she said. Her daughter screamed with laughter. Mrs. Smith trembled with excitement when it was her turn. "Somebody is coming home to you," Mrs. Gray said slowly. "He's carrying a rifle on his back, and he's almost there." Mrs. Smith felt as if she could hardly breathe. "And there he is," Mrs. Gray cried, pointing to the road. They all rushed to the door to look. A man in a blue coat, with a gun on his back, was walking down the road toward the Smith farm. His face was hidden by a large pack on his back. Laughing and crying, Mrs. Smith grabbed her hat and her children and ran out of the house. She hurried down the road after him, calling his name and pulling her children along with her. But the soldier was too far away for her voice to reach him. When she got back to their farm, she saw the man standing by the fence. He was looking at the little house and the field of yellow wheat. The sun was almost touching the hills in the west. The cowbells rang softly as the animals moved toward the barn. "How peaceful it all is," Private Smith thought. "How far away from the battles, the hospitals, the wounded, and the dead. My little farm in Wisconsin. How could I have left it for those years of killing and suffering?" Trembling and weak with emotion, Mrs. Smith hurried up to her husband. Her feet made no sound on the grass. But he turned suddenly to face her. For the rest of his life, he would never forget her face at that moment. "Emma," he cried. The children stood back, watching their mother kissing this strange man. He saw them, and kneeling down, he pulled from his pack three huge red apples. In a moment, all three children were in their father's arms. Together, the family entered the little, unpainted farmhouse. Later that evening, after supper, Smith and his wife went outside. The moon was bright above the eastern hills. Sweet, peaceful stars filled the sky as the night birds sang softly and tiny insects buzzed in the soft air. His farm needed work. His children needed clothing. He was no longer young and strong, but he began to plan for next year. With the same courage he had faced the war, Private Smith faced his difficult future.
That was The Return of a Private by Hamlin Garland. We will be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Hope you will join us then. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.